Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hey, I'm Roberta Blevins, and this is Life After MLM, a podcast where we work to end the stigma of failure in an industry systemically designed for you to fail. Join us as we dive into the real-life stories of survivors, experts, and advocates, as we debunk the common myths and fallacies of cults, frauds, scams, and multi-level marketing. Hey, Hunbots and Hunbros, we have a bonus episode for you today that came out of a watch party on the Discord. So if you're not in the Discord and you haven't joined us for watch parties, then you don't know, but we try to watch different documentaries or TV shows that sort of fit into the theme of the podcast. And one of the shows that we watched earlier this year was The Curious Case of Natalia Grace. I knew that we were going to be talking about different types of child abuse in April, and so I had a conversation with one of our listeners who's also a member of the Discord and watched that documentary with us and has a unique perspective because of what she does for a living, and she wanted to come on the show and discuss some of the nuances of this documentary. It's not something that I've done too many times, but I actually really enjoyed this conversation, going down the documentary, talking about what we liked and what we didn't like about it, talking about the ethical reporting of it and sort of how things were presented and things that we felt should have been addressed a little bit more. If you have not watched The Curious Case of Natalia Grace, I don't think this episode will be too confusing, but if you've wanted to watch The Curious Case of Natalia Grace and you haven't yet, I would suggest watching it. Whether you want to watch it after this or before is up to you. I think actually maybe listening to this first would be kind of like a pretty good roadmap, because the documentary is kind of all over the place. But if you want to listen to the documentary without any bias or preconceived notions at all, go ahead and watch both seasons of that documentary and then listen to this and see if you agree with our opinions and discussions on this. The content warnings are the same that they have been all month. We are talking about child abuse. This episode deals with adoption specifically and child abuse and violence and special needs. And so it is a heavy episode. Again, it is a companion episode to the documentary, if you want to call it that, about this story. So they do go together. We also go down a couple of the Reddit rabbit hole theories about this documentary. So I went ahead and threw the Natalia Grace Reddit into the show notes as well. You can also find a link to watch seasons both 1 and 2 in the show notes as well. We will see you for our last child abuse specific episode for the month of April this Sunday, and then we are back to more MLM episodes. Enjoy. Welcome back to another episode of Life After MLM. This is kind of a fun episode. It's a bonus episode. I told you guys that we would be having bonus episodes, but this episode was actually prompted and sort of created in the Life After MLM Discord. If you're not there, what are you doing with your life? It is so fun. We try to have watch parties every week, whether they're scheduled or they're sort of impromptu. And one of the first watch parties that we had was a documentary that everybody was talking about called The Curious Case of Natalia Grace. And we watched it. We were shocked. We were horrified. We laughed. We were confused. It ran the gamut of all the emotions. I was really interested in this story because everybody was talking about it. And I said, if anybody wants to talk about this, reach out. Our wonderful guest today, Casey, was like, hey, I want to talk about this. I have a unique opinion in this field, and I would love to come on the show and help you make an episode. So I would love to welcome to the show, Casey. How are you doing?
Pretty good. I was telling you earlier, I'm worn out this week.
I completely understand. So let's get into this. We watched this documentary, The Curious Case of Natalia Grace. If you guys haven't seen it, we're going to be talking about it. So there will be spoilers. So you might not want to listen to this, or you might want to come back to it. It is essentially a documentary about a young girl who gets adopted through sort of various ways, kind of ping pongs around the system, and ends up with a family who we're not really sure of. The story is kind of confusing. Everything is left on a cliffhanger. We're going to talk about sort of our opinions on the production of this as well. But essentially, she ends up in this family. The family believes that she's older than she is. They are able to successfully rehome her, get her out of the house. There's a lot of abuse. It's a very strange story. And so we're having Casey come on because I said, again, she has this unique opinion because of what she does in her real life. So Casey, please explain what you do for a living, what you're going to school for, and how this case impacted you.
Yes, thank you. I am a case manager for Medicaid currently, for a Medicaid plan that serves foster care youth and former foster care youth. That includes children that are actively in the system. It includes young adults who have aged out, and then especially adopted families. So if a family has adopted a child from foster care, they get part of the benefit that they get a subsidy payment, and then they get Medicaid for a time. It kind of depends, usually until they're 18. And so I work with families trying to make sure kids are getting their preventative services, trying to connect them with resources. A lot of times that involves post-adoption issues that take place after a child's already adopted. And that in itself is a whole world that I don't think a lot of people understand. And then previous to my current job, I worked for Medicare, Medicaid plan, also in case management, serving seniors and people with disabilities. My brother is himself disabled, both physically and with special needs. So disabled people and children are definitely close to my heart. Currently, I'm going to school to get my master's in social work.
That's quite the resume. I could see why you were passionate when we were watching this documentary about wanting to talk about some of the issues that affected the family and Natalia as well. So let's sort of get into this documentary. There are two different seasons. It's going to kind of ping pong around because I'm also going to talk about the production quality. Not that it was a bad production, but I think I'm kind of uniquely in this space as being someone who's been in a documentary that I felt was done really ethically, especially with the victims of telling their story and the way that everything was handled, the way that it rolled out, and the reception. And for some reason, it was kind of strange. Like, I felt like there was kind of a narrative, and that the first couple episodes really sort of intentionally led us down the wrong path. And I had a little bit of resentment over that because it felt more like a reality TV show than like a documentary, the way that the narrative was sort of crafted in those first couple episodes. What do you think?
Absolutely. I don't think it was kind of crafted. It was absolutely crafted to be sensational. I don't necessarily know if the fault lies completely on the production company, because I first started learning about Natalia Grace, I want to say, it felt like 2016, 2017. I remember seeing like a clickbaity article, like on social media, about the real story behind The Orphan.
Mm-hmm.
And it said that this family says that their six-year-old was actually, I don't even know if it said 22 at the time. It had some outrageous age. But quite, like, from the beginning, this article was comparing the situation to the movie The Orphan. And I remember even seeing articles that said the real story. Like, I thought, so they're saying that the movie The Orphan was based on this story. So I just kind of loosely followed it, mostly clickbaity articles. And then I remember Natalia going on Dr. Phil and so on. But the story itself was sensationalized even before this production team was probably involved. And I don't know. I don't know if news broke after like the court cases started getting filed. I kind of speculated myself that maybe either Christine or Michael had put out a story themselves. Like, it seemed to come out of nowhere. But then once the court cases were filed, news stations were reporting, and news, just regular old news stations, were like, The Orphan, is this really a story straight out of the movie? Is the, you know, it was sensationalized even before the production company.
I completely agree with you. I absolutely remember the clickbait articles. I absolutely saw them too. I don't know if this is some weird, like, Berenstain Mandela effect kind of thing that's happening, but I remember it. So I'm with you. I remember there being articles saying, like, the true story of The Orphan, and reading them and being like, oh my God, what? Because it felt, again, so sensationalized, so unbelievable, so out of left field, that it was too wild not to be true.
Yeah. And then, of course, in the first season, once the series starts going, right off the bat, we have, you know, even in the intro, we have the spooky music. We have pictures of little Natalia with her sweet little baby face. The pictures are darkened. There's, you know, distortion made. Clearly, from the beginning, the production company wanted to play into the mystery. I mean, as if there was a mystery. I mean, it's in the name, The Curious Case. Like, the only thing curious about this is how so many people have failed this child.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like, the two questions I have is, like, who's actually telling the truth here? And how did this child slip through so many cracks?
Yeah.
I felt like there was nobody in her corner. And maybe there was. Maybe the documentary doesn't really show the entire story. Maybe there were people in her corner that didn't have ulterior motives, which we'll get into as well as we get a little deeper into this. But for me, you're right. It was very menacing. There's this dark music. All of the photos that were taken of Natalia in the very beginning of the series that's shown are of her sort of kind of looking a little older. And it makes you go, maybe she isn't six. She does kind of look a little older there. She's wearing clothes that maybe make her look older, or she has makeup on, or she's done up in a certain way. She's sitting next to somebody else, and by extension, she looks older and bigger because she's next to someone younger and smaller. It's very interesting how all of these little things are sort of laid, like placed on a map. Like, this is the next thing you're going to feel. And then we're going to show you this picture, and then you're going to feel that way. And I understand, for like a dramatic show, yeah, show flashbacks, flash forward to the beginning, do whatever. But for a documentary, for me, not telling this story like honestly and linearly was odd. I felt so confused, and I don't usually feel confused when watching an educational documentary. I feel confused when I'm watching a drama, because I'm being intentionally misled and left on cliffhangers. And it really felt more like, you know, like if TLC made a documentary, not if like a documentary company made a documentary. It just felt performative and sensationalized to me.
I don't think it was meant to be an educational docuseries. Clearly meant to be entertainment. I understand that we all love true crime. We don't love it, but we all have an interest in seeing stories of people who have survived horrific things. We love a good mystery. But when you take into account like the whole overall picture, this is about a disabled child who was basically shopped around and horrifically abused and abandoned and demonized. And the way this was edited, in my opinion, kind of furthered that. It just helped precipitate this weird perception of her. And I wouldn't even say that she looked older in any of the pictures. What she looked like was traumatized. She could look angry. Some people may perceive some pictures of her face as angry. They'll show a picture of her look, you know, kind of looking scary. And then when you see the video clip of where that image was taken, it is just so heartbreaking. Like, that is the face of a traumatized child who is actively being abused right in on camera. And by abuse, like some of those scenarios where she was being interrogated, she clearly just didn't know what was happening, what was going on. Most of those videos, she was being like punished or talked down to in some way. And they snipped those and they're like, oh, let's show her how she looks scary and angry.
It was strange. It was strange. And it really felt watching it. I mean, obviously there was entertainment and it almost became kind of ridiculous, like a reality TV show, because you have these characters and it's not like characters in Lula Rich where you're like, oh, there's Becca. She likes to investigate internet scams. Like, it wasn't like that. It was like, oh, here's Michael. What the fuck? And you'd have, and this person that was her supposed to be her father, her adopted father, he's so all over the place with his emotions and he's flinging his hands in the air and he's crying and he's shouting and he's punching the floor and he's claiming that his wife withheld sex and that's abuse and we were all abused and all of these things. And you're just like, what is going on with this guy? It's just like, I feel like I was really misled, because what happens is, the next season was called Natalia Speaks. And then all of a sudden, here is the victim who has all kinds of stuff to say about the first season. And what struck me, I was like, why wouldn't her parents think, or the mom's not involved, so why wouldn't the people involved not think that Natalia would see this and would want to respond? It almost felt like everything was placed and intentional and guided. And it upsets me because there's such an easy way to do this ethically and to tell true crime in a way that is educational and consumable and isn't exploitative. And especially a little girl that had been exploited her entire life by these systems and these families. And then again, as an adult, is being exploited in the retelling of her story. And she's involved in it.
Yeah. Well, I will say the first season came out, I think it was either this past spring of 2023, spring or summer. So there was a little bit of time. Like, they advertised at the end of season one that there was going to be a Natalia Speaks. And supposedly the reason Natalia couldn't speak in the first one is because she was under a gag order with the pending litigation. But yeah, you all could have held it until then. Like, I can imagine being a production company and wanting to capture this story that it's so outrageous and outlandish. You know, could this be a real orphan case? Could this little person be pretending to be a child when they're really an adult? But quite early, it would have to be. Like, the first interviews of Michael Barnett are in like 2017. They had to have sat in front of Michael Barnett in 2017 and been like, holy shit, this man is insane. This man, like, how could they have believed the narrative that he was telling? And I mean, I feel like that's a little harsh, because I think Michael can be a very convincing person only because he has so much passion behind when he talks. He has so much conviction. So I don't know. Part of me, I can see it. And part of me, I am like, what were y'all thinking? How did you keep running with this story and decide to tell it this way?
Let's take it back to sort of the beginning, and we'll try to tell this as in a linear fashion as best as we can, with me asking you questions about the system along the way. So essentially what happens is, she was born in 2003, I believe. Is that what the final, I mean, this is, it's still confusing. 2003. So in 2003, she's born in the Ukraine, special needs, to a mother who has enough children and is like, I cannot afford another child. I can't do this.
She needed surgeries because of her medical conditions. And in Ukraine, you have to pay for things. You don't just get to take your baby home
right.
without paying. So they told her you could put her in the orphanage yeah. and she'll get the surgeries that she needs. And that's what she had to do.
So Natalia is sent to a Ukrainian orphanage. At what age is she officially adopted? I want to say she was about 4.
I think it was 2009 with the Chacones. Was it 2008? Yeah, 4 or 5, I think. The Chacones only had her for about a year or so.
She's with this family, the Chacones, the Chaconis. It's said both ways in the documentary. And there are some problems and she's put back into the system. Is that sort of what happens?
Well, not really put back into the system. It was a private adoption. From what I understood, they showed some documents in the documentary, like an email from the Chacones or Chaconis that said they had adopted a previous child from Ukraine. So I guess they just, you know, were passionate about adopting children from Ukraine. And that was a private adoption, of course. And when they had problems with Natalia, supposedly the problems, as Natalia says it, is she was roughhousing with one of the siblings and she fell on his arm and hurt his arm. And it was like from that moment on, the way she tells it, they didn't love her anymore, basically. They didn't want her. There's also, in the documentary, it's speculated that maybe they kind of bit off more than they could chew because she had so many medical needs and costs. So she wasn't put back into the system. She wasn't ever quite in a system. The confusing and sad part, you know, she might have been more protected if she was in any kind of system, surprisingly. So the Chacones contacted a adoption agency and were trying to get her basically, it's called like unregulated readoption.
Yeah, basically like rehomed.
Yeah.
I mean, they were like, this is too much. Sorry, we thought we could. And it's not a system, but she goes back into this adoption cycle.
Yeah.
How often does this sort of thing happen when a family adopts a child and it doesn't work out and the child is put back into the cycle?
It happens quite a bit. I think the statistics are pretty out. Like it's something that's hard to track, something that's hard to regulate. There's so many different moving parts. There are adoptions that get disrupted before it's ever final. Then there are adoptions that are discontinued after the adoption's final, but then they pick back up. There are some cases where families will give back custody of their child to the state temporarily and then get them back. Usually those are more for like mental health treatment purposes. But I want to say, in my line of work, post-adoption issues are pretty much at least a weekly occurrence. It's just a regular part of working with foster and adopted families. I think I saw a statistic as anywhere from 2 to 20% of adoptions. That's a huge variance. I mean, possibly up to a quarter of adoptions in some places disrupt.
And those are the kids that are in the system, not the ones that are falling through the cracks and are in different placement arrangements.
I think it includes both. I think it includes adoptions from foster okay. care and private adoptions. However, I don't know if it accounts that unregulated custody transfer. That's actually what it's called, what Natalia experienced.
Okay, an unregulated custody transfer.
Yeah. And I don't know if I like that term because in some ways it was regulated. Like, you know, there wasn't a private adoption agency involved. There was a what's called an ICPC, Interstate Compact Agreement, that allowed her to be adopted into another state. But I guess what's unregulated was it wasn't facilitated by the government or social services.
Right. Okay. So Natalia gets put back into this adoption cycle. And there are a couple families that want to adopt her. But it's almost like they don't have enough money or something like that. It almost kind of felt like an adoption scam. They didn't go too much into it, but there were a couple of families who would have been really fantastic fits for Natalia. There was a family who had another daughter who had dwarfism, very similar to the dwarfism that Natalia had. And she lived with them for a while and they got along famously. That fell through. There was another family and they wanted to adopt a baby who had achondroplasia as well. And that one fell through. And it was very strange. And I don't know if, because it's all speculation, but can you speak to why possibly that might have happened?
That part of it, I kind of have to go based off what the documentary showed, but they said supposedly the Chacons, I guess in partnership with the adoption agency they reached back out to, started reaching out to Little People of America. And honestly, when I saw that, I was like, oh, yes, like put her with a family that can understand, you know, her life experience. But it was almost like they were auctioning, wanting to like shop her around to various families. The strictly private adoption world, I'm not as familiar with, where there's no state intervention. From my understanding is that's pretty common. You know, the private adoption industry is its own beast, I think, with its own set of problems.
Do you ever wonder how much of your personal data is out there on the internet just for anyone to find? I promise it's more than you think. Your name, contact info, social security number, home address, even information about your family members. It's all being compiled by data brokers and openly sold online. This can lead to a lot of problems, including identity theft, phishing attempts, harassment, and unwanted spam calls. But now you can protect your privacy with Delete Me. Signing up for the service is super easy. Just provide DeleteMe with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts take it from there. They send you regular, personalized privacy reports showing what info they found, where they found it, and what they removed. I got my report, and I was floored with the results. Of the 105 data brokers they checked, 83 of them had my data. DeleteMe then removed 173 listings of my personal data off the internet. And they make sure that it stays off too. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me at a special discount just for our listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/MLM and use promo code MLM at checkout. The only way to get the 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/MLM and enter code MLM at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/MLM, code MLM.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
All of these adoptions fall through, these private adoptions, and she ends up with the family, the Barnett family, the one that we were talking about in the beginning. The mom is abusive. The dad is all over the place. They have another son who's special needs. The mom had gotten pretty well known for writing a book about being like a super mom with a kid with special needs. And there was a lot of speculation that they were trying to adopt a child with special needs so that she could like do it again. I don't know how much of that is real, but there was a lot of speculation and sort of a lot of hinting toward that in the documentary as well. It's hard for me because so many people tell so many white lies or lie by omission or twist their words and the meanings of those words in their interviews and contradict themselves in later interviews that it's really hard for me to trust almost anything in that documentary. So like everything, I was like, I don't know, maybe. It's really weird. And I know I said it already, but I don't think I've ever watched something that's supposed to be educational and come away from it more confused than when I went in.
Yeah. Just to back up, I forgot to mention before she came to the Barnetts, I want to kind of make this known for anybody who did not watch it or maybe watched in passing and maybe that part didn't sink in. But Natalia, these families that she was sent to, the little people families that she was sent to see if they wanted to adopt her, they loved her. Like all of them attested to that they loved her. And one family in particular, the DePauls, they thought they were going to adopt her. She was perfect. Like I think that was the family, main family you're mentioning. They never reported any problems with Natalia. And the reason, I just wanted to clarify, the reason those adoptions fell through, as it was depicted in the documentary, is that the adoption agency would come back and say the Chacones wanted them to cover like past medical costs. So costs that they had incurred on behalf of Natalia, they wanted the new family to cover those, supposedly. And then there was the second season alleged that there was a CPS investigation on the first adoptive family, the Chacones, and maybe they thought the DePauls had done it. These issues were never about Natalia. Just to your point about how difficult the adoption system is. But I think the average viewer, apparently, according to the comment sections on social media, the average viewer sees that and they're like, oh, there must be something wrong with Natalia. She's the problem, when she was literally 5-6 years old.
And even though the documentary does make it out for a good long portion of the documentary that Natalia is secretly like a 22-year-old Ukrainian, I don't know, they make her out to be all kinds of things, like she's promiscuous and she's seducing the men in town and she's doing this and that. And it's just very nefarious. And they make it out and you start to believe it because the evidence that they're showing you, you're like, oh yeah, no, she doesn't have baby teeth in those photos. And what do you mean? That's so strange. But then, and again, like the documentary is presenting this in the first season as evidence, like weird, how strange. In the second season, they talk to like doctors who had been Natalia's doctors, Natalia's dentists, different people in Natalia's life. And they say, you know, the Barnetts came to us because this all goes, I didn't mention it, but this all goes into this thing where they wanted to get her re-aged, right? That she's really this 22-year-old vamp, like just out to get them and murder them with knives or something. And they're showing all these photos in the first season where you're like, oh, she doesn't have baby teeth. That's strange. Maybe she is a 22-year-old harlot. I don't even know the right word to explain because it's just so absurd. And then in the second season, you see pictures around the same time where Natalia's smiling and you're like, that's a mouthful of baby teeth. Like, why didn't I see this picture in the first season? They talk to the dentist and the dentist is like, yeah, when we did this exam and these x-rays when Natalia was allegedly 8, these x-rays, and I told the family this, these x-rays, she's between 7 and 9 years old based on these x-rays, based on how many baby teeth she has still left. And it's like, those things were there. Those things had been established. The doctors had talked to the family. There was written evidence that the family had received. Yes, based on Natalia's bone structure, based on Natalia's blood work, based on Natalia's baby teeth, based on everything that's happened medically, she is between the ages of 6 and 10 years old, like every single person. And yet for some reason in the first season of this documentary, like none of that is presented at all. It does not come in until Natalia's like, excuse me, hi, I'm Natalia. I'm not actually 36 right now, or whatever her adjusted age had been legally versus biologically. And so let's talk about this re-aging thing, because it seems really absurd to decide to re-age a child, and for what reason?
Yes, I mean, I don't even know where to begin. I've never quite heard of re-aging. I will say, there's certain aspects of adoption that are somewhat a violation of children's rights in general that probably aid into this concept of re-aging as being like an acceptable thing, apparently. Like, for example, in a lot of states, I think most, if not all states, when you adopt a child, their birth certificate is changed and that it doesn't matter what age they were adopted. So, you know, a child can spend the first 5 years of their life with their biological mother, go into foster care for whatever reason, become adopted, and paper-wise, it's like they never were with their mother. A lot of states are very limited as to what rights the children have as far as like knowing who their biological parents are, seeing the details of their adoption, their paperwork, knowing where they came from. I feel like there's little nuances like that in this just topic that probably added to the re-aging thing. When we think about children, I don't think we think about how they are truly the most vulnerable members of our society, period. Like, they have absolutely no control over their life circumstances. You know, they really don't have a say. So when a parent brings their child into their family doctor that they've known for 10 plus years and says, she's really 22 years old, just ask her. when a parent brings to the court, you know, signed papers from a doctor and from a social worker that says, oh, I can attest that Natalia needs to be re-aged to 22. She's much older than 8 years old. There's kind of some nuances in place in our society and our culture that we're like, okay, we'll believe these parents. In Natalia's case, like largely, if not almost everyone, was influenced either directly or indirectly by the Barnetts.
It's just so strange to me because it's like, why? And if you go on Reddit and you read the comments and you speculate with people and you sort of break it down and you start going, oh, well, that kind of actually makes more sense than what they're saying. Like the re-aging thing is a way to get rid of somebody, especially if you are indebted for a specific amount of time or to a specific age, like 21 years old. And when you look at all of the evidence, and again, this is all speculation, and this is all just comes from the documentary and how it was presented. The Barnett family, if we believe that Christine wanted to redo the Supermom book, like, look what I did, I can do it again, sort of thing that she was going towards, because she does mention her book deal and her money and things in the documentary. If we believe that's the case, then that leads us to believe that Natalia wasn't the one. And so we can't really have Natalia because it's not working out. I'm not the super mom I thought it was, and I need this person out of our family. Again, total speculation. If we also believe that, then we also have to believe that a super mom can't just like rehome her kid. Because that's not what a supermom would do. Like, if she really is the supermom, then problems wouldn't be a problem. She would be able to overcome them because that's what the whole book is about. And so if you look at it that way and you realize, oh, well, admitting she's not a supermom would be bad for her brand. But if she can make it look, again, all alleged, if she can make it look like this person is bad and she's just removing the bad from their life, then she can still look like that supermom. Because they tried to get Natalia committed. They tried to get her arrested. There were knives involved. Natalia's like, I can't even grip a knife. I don't know what they're talking about. They tried to get her institutionalized. And then when that didn't work, they got her re-aged and they moved her out into her own apartment at like 7, 8 years old. It's strange. You know, again, it's all speculation, but it makes sense. If you look at it from that desperation side, that this is a way to get rid of a quote problem, which is a horrific way to talk about a child, but a problem in our lives without us looking like the bad guys. Like, she's crazy. She's a murderer. She's really 22. All of these things were roads that this family went down in almost, I think, this order. It could have been murder first and then institution. I'm not sure. But in this order to get this little girl out of their lives. And her whole story is like fraught with abuse and neglect. And it's just, it's horrific. I don't know of any other speculation that I've seen of anybody going, well, here's another theory that's made the most sense except for that one. And to believe that one is horrific, that somebody could be so cold and calculated and manipulative to like harm a tiny child with special needs who just wants to be loved more than anything in the whole entire world.
And I don't even think about the attempts to have her arrested, institutionalized, etc., as individual like attempts to get rid of her. They were all honestly pretty common steps in the post-adoption process. And I'm not saying that adopted parents do this on purpose. By and large, obviously, Michael and Christine are a very extreme situation, but that's what the post-adoption world looks like. That's what post-adoption services are when they're actually regulated with social services and help. Normally, a parent, like say they adopted a child from foster care, they could reach out to the state social services and be like, we're having these problems. The problems that adoptive parents report are not unlike what the accusations were of Natalia. It's actually, with exception of, you know, it being so extreme that she's really an adult pretending to be a kid, that, yeah, that's out of the ordinary. But everything else, all the behaviors, all the claims of fecal matter, of threatening to harm, of playing with knives, of lying, it's just on par. sometimes those things might really be happening. Like there's, you know, there's plenty of reasons why children post-adoption are going to have behavioral problems. That's just a given. Adoption in itself is trauma. And normally you don't adopt a child who's had a non-traumatic life. But yeah, normally parents would contact social services. There can be different mental health service programs that they attempt to try. There's different levels. You know, you would start with outpatient therapy, and then there could be some in-home services, and then there may be inpatient residential treatment and things like that. But regularly, I have experienced parents calling, being like, we're done. We're just done. Okay, well, let's look at therapy. No, we're, you know, we don't want to do that. Well, let's, what about this? No, we don't want to do that. Sometimes in those cases, you'll see like their claims escalate. And it's not necessarily that child is just a complete angel and does not have behavioral issues. They certainly do. But the parents' reaction and, you know, participation, things don't happen in a vacuum. It's a family problem. But there's been some cases where I have flat out believed the parents to be lying, to be flat out fabricating things. Just like in the case of Natalia, this happens. I don't want to like besmirch foster and adoptive parents and act like they're just all bad people, because they're not. They're amazing people. But these issues are very complex that occur. And having issues after adoption, it's not just common. It's like as to be expected. You know, you don't just wave a magic wand and fix a child, quote, fix. You know, they're not something to be fixed.
Raising kids isn't easy. Biological, adopted, foster, it doesn't matter. It's not easy. Even just a friend spending the weekend with you and influencing children and taking care of children and making sure their needs are met, making sure that they're happy, making sure that they're well taken care of and loved. It's tough. It's really hard. It's not like movies and TV shows. And I could imagine being an adoptive parent in these situations on both sides, where you feel like you're at your wit's end and you don't know what to do as the adoptive parent. And also at the same time, like being that child who is like, this is not my life. This is not my family. Like, it is such a hard place to be. And again, like you're saying, adoption is trauma. There's no adoption that isn't, because there's always going to be something, you know, unexpected or sad that caused the reason that this has to happen. And, you know, I think a lot of times we don't think about that kind of stuff. And I agree. I know some of the most incredible adoptive parents where I am like, you know what? You were made to be a mom. Like in this way, this maternal instinct that you have, the way, the command you have over your brood, like this is your thing. I have two girls and it is a lot of work. I could just imagine just so many unexpected things that could come up, even like not knowing family history with diseases and things, and having to come across these things as an adoptive parent and rolling through the punches and figuring things out with a child that you don't know the same way, and a family that has to adapt as it changes and grows. It's a very difficult place to be. And I salute people that go down this journey and go through this, because I know it's not easy. It's not like, you know what we should do? We should adopt a baby tomorrow. It's not like that. It's really, like you said, it's trauma. It's trauma from the moment almost of birth for some of these kids. It's trauma.
Yes.
And then to be thrown through the ringer with this bullshit of these Barnetts and all of the things that they brought unnecessarily to this little girl's life.
When I say that what they did with Natalia, the kind of sequence of events of, okay, let's now we're having these problems. Let's tell everybody about it. Let's tell our entire family that she has pubic hair, supposedly. Let's start spreading this mystery. And then let's start reporting these incidents, calling the cops, taking her to therapist, you know, claiming that we have all these behaviors at home. I think that just was part of their overall mission. I don't think it was like one individual fell swoop to get rid of her, because if they wanted to, quote, get rid of her, what they would have had in the most ethical way possible was they would have had to contact social services and been like, hey, we got this kid that has all these behaviors. They would have had to say all this stuff is going on, and social services would have investigated, and they would have said, you know, a big red flag that I think gets overlooked is the fact that they claim that Natalia was frankly trying to kill their children, their other children in the home, and hurting them. you need to report that. Like, you have a duty to protect your biological children. So if that's really happening, why did you call nobody? If you really thought your children's lives were in danger, what the hell? What does that say about you?
Right.
What does it say about you? And they didn't, because it wasn't true.
Right.
And because they knew that their shit was going to get set on fire. There was a piece of paper at some point shown in the documentary, and it said that Natalia is very rehearsed and very familiar with social services and blah, blah, blah. Bitch, where? Like, how is she? Because, you know, they took her out of school, and then she really didn't see a soul, at least what was presented in the documentary. There was not social service intervention until after she was supposedly an adult.
It's very interesting because it almost feels like they had this very calculated effort to create a perfect paper trail, but they forgot to like check the boxes that like actual people would double check to make sure that paper trail was in fact intact. Like, they claim that she tried to kill them, but there's no police reports of them reporting that. There's no reports of them reporting that anywhere.
Yeah.
Every time that Natalia did something bad, like poisoning the coffee, like it's very scripted and just happens that Christine catches her and gets a video of it. And so it's very like, they're like, look at this evidence. And like experts are like, it's super fabricated and very intentional. And it sucks to hear you say that some of those things are common and common ways that people try to get out of their responsibility when they go into adoption and foster care and wanting to help kids. Obviously, the reaging thing is a little out there, like I think most people think. But one of the things that backfired on the Barnetts, which there's a lot of schadenfreude in this documentary, even though it's horrific and it's about this little girl. But there's a part of me that was like very petty and like, you deserve it. The Barnetts are successfully able to reage her. And in doing so, they kick her out and they get her an apartment. And they basically leave, I think she was like 7 or 8 at the time. And they just leave this little 7 or 8 year old girl living in an apartment by herself. Like, she doesn't have electricity for a couple days. Like, she runs out of food. And because of their neglect of this adult, right? Now she's 22. She's aged out. She's no longer legally their responsibility. They're just being good folks and taking care of her when they can. Because of all of this neglect, Natalia starts to wander around and she meets the neighbors. And in meeting the neighbors, this family sort of falls in love with her and they're like, what's going on? What's happening? And they start taking her in and they start feeding her and they start spending time with her. And this is the man's family. And the man's then basically get Natalia to like sign over all of her checks and all of the money that she has going to her that was going to the Barnetts, like her food stamps. And I think there was like a couple other checks, maybe social security or something like that, that was going to her that she signs over to the man's. So this is when the schadenfreude comes in, because the Barnetts that did not want her, could not wait to get her out of their house fast enough, re-aged her and kicked her out, are no longer getting the financial tithing from Natalia anymore because she has signed it over to someone else. Mind you, they know she's not 22. There's no way they don't know that she's not 22, right? Multiple doctors have told them their entire time with this girl that she was not that age. When they realize that they're no longer going to collect this money because essentially they made her an adult and she legally signed it away to somebody else, was probably my favorite part of the whole entire documentary. Because I was like, that's what you get, bitch. I was so angry. And then the pettiness inside of me of being like, oh, girl, Natalia, that's right. But then also you have this other family, the man's family, that you get to know. And I'm not sure I trust them either. I'm not sure that I think that they adopted or brought Natalia into their family for the most altruistic motives either. I'm not sure how I feel about them.
I want to be careful with how I talk about them publicly, just because, like, I have some concerns. I have some criticisms, and we'll probably get into the, like, end of the series, which that's the biggest part of, you know, my concerns. But I do want to be careful with how I express my feelings about them, and I hope other people that care about Natalia do too, just because, you know, from all we know, Natalia is still a member of their family. She's not living with them anymore, but she loves them. And from all we know, they were the first real family that she had. And for someone that's been traumatized as much as her, she already has to deal with the most unimaginable criticisms I've ever seen from social media. And so, yeah, I don't want to dog her mom and dad, but I do have concerns.
I feel the same way.
I think anytime, well, I'll say speak generally. A lot of times when you have a foster or adoptive family that has very fundamentalist religious beliefs, there's going to be a higher risk of there being problems.
Yeah.
There's rigid behavior expectations, rigid thought expectations. There's particular beliefs and misconceptions about how you deal with trauma. Pray it away. You trust in God and he will heal you. And that may or may not be conducive to a child or a young adult who has been through this type of trauma. I'm sure that Natalia's faith has helped her in this situation. Maybe not necessarily just the faith, but having that family connection, because that's how healing occurs, is through connections with other people. So I don't want to besmirch her faith either. But yeah, it's potentially a high-risk situation. And when you have a career foster family that, you know, that's basically their main purpose or main job is to take in youth, there's incentives there. Some families may not be doing it for altruistic purposes. They may be doing it not just for financial incentives, but going back to the religious aspect, there's this culture of saviorism within fostering and adopting, where parents think, oh, I'm going to fix this child. I'm saving them. I'm doing them a favor. And when those kids act like kids and they're not grateful enough, it's a betrayal. It's like, how could you betray me after all I did for you? And, you know, there's those elements in biological parent-child relationships too, but more so when it's foster and adopted. And the truth of it is that kids should not have to be grateful. Like, they should learn gratitude. They should learn respect. They should appreciate their caregivers, sure. But grateful, I don't know. Children didn't ask to be brought here. They didn't ask to be born. Foster and adopted children certainly didn't ask to end up where they've ended up. And all children get to take full liberties of their parents' gifts. And children should be spoiled. Children should be able to take for granted what their parents did for them, that their parents gave them the basic necessities of life. And when I say that foster and adoptive parents, oftentimes that's one of the complaints is that their children aren't grateful. It's not like they just bought them the newest iPhone or like these luxury items and they're spoiled brats. There's an underlying belief sometimes that they expect them to owe them their life basically just because they housed and clothed them and fed them. There's a saviorism aspect. There's some people that seemingly, you know, even though they did it from their heart, like they wanted to help this child, there may be some people that are doing it, you know, for the kudos points, for the notoriety, for, I guess, the points to get into heaven. I don't know. There's very much some savior complexes involved.
No, I agree with you. Absolutely. We see that a lot in, I don't want to throw a whole nother group of people under the bus, but we see that sort of behavior a lot in like the family vlogging channels, where you've got these families with these kids that are like forced to do certain things and like, you should be grateful. Look at what we have. And it is, you know, when I saw that the man's family, and thankful that they love Natalia for sure, but when I saw that the man's family were as evangelical as they were, I believe I said, oh, out of one frying pan and into another frying pan. Because she got away from the Barnetts and found a family that loved her. But it reminded me a lot of Marilyn's episode where she is lost in the system as a lost child sleeping on couches and then gets adopted by this evangelical family that basically pushes her into another cult. Like, it was just upsetting. And so even seeing that happen with Natalia, there were a lot of things that I was connecting to episodes we had already had, conversations we had already had on the show, conversations that I want to have going forward. And I was like, oh my gosh, like this documentary, though it's not MLM, has so many of the same core things where you've got like people with their belief systems and people trying to do what's best and doing things that they think is good, but it's not. Like, there's just so many similarities. And we enjoyed watching it so much on Discord and having the conversations about it. And so many people asked me if I was going to cover it. And I was like, oh, we're watching in the Discord. I thought we should do an episode about this. But the only other thing that we haven't covered that I know that you wanted to talk about, and it goes into this whole, like, a lot of these areas not being as regulated as they should be. And again, it's something we've talked about in the past, but that is homeschooling and the lack of regulation within homeschooling. And I bring that up because Natalia was removed from school and was homeschooled. And so it sort of connects. You guys are following. I know you are. But let's talk about homeschooling and the lack of regulation, because we're also going to be doing more episodes going forward this year about homeschooling and IBLP and different things like that sort of intersect as well.
I have a personal experience with homeschooling myself, so I may have some biases, but yeah, homeschooling is kind of a little sidecar issue going on here, that just the lack of regulation. From my knowledge, Indiana, Natalia State, has absolutely no requirements whatsoever to homeschool. Some states require a parent to write a letter to the school board, superintendent, just attesting that they're going to homeschool. Very few states have much regulation at all. Indiana has nothing. You don't have to tell them you're going to homeschool. You don't have to do nothing. So, yeah, Natalia started when she came to the Barnetts. They enrolled her in first grade. And by her account, she loved it. She had never been to school before. So a previous adopted family, I guess, had never enrolled her into kindergarten or preschool or anything. So, yeah, she said that she loved school, loved her friends, loved her teachers. In season two, they had a teacher interview on the documentary that said that she was a delight, that they really loved her. They noted that she was, you know, pretty much just completely on target for what they would have expected for her age. Then, from my memory, Christine started asking the teacher, don't you think she's older than what she's supposed to be? Don't you think she's too advanced to be 6 years old? And the teacher's like, no. They didn't really go into too many specifics, but they just alluded to having issues, like not liking the Barnetts. Like, they felt like they were being mean to Natalia, was what they said. And so I'm sure they, some point, they started kind of maybe questioning the parents, maybe standing up for Natalia a little bit. And the documentary did not say that there was any kind of CPS report or anything like that, but just the Barnetts up and took her out of school. And then she was homeschooled. And, you know, from that moment on, there was no one that really was in Natalia's life that was looking out for her other than those people in that house. There are no checks and balances whatsoever.
No. It's really sad. And it's an issue that happens. And though Natalia's case is unique, it is not alone in there being a problem within these systems and in the way that we protect our children. And this year, you know, we've already talked about different types of grooming and how to spot a spider. And we're going to continue to do this red flag education so that we can protect our kids. Because if we're going to say, hey, protect the kids, then I think we should be a little bit more knowledgeable about what we're talking about and talking about topics that actually affect us. And I know we've got homeschool parents that listen. I know we've got adoptive parents that listen who are passionate, who see the cracks and who see kids fall through the cracks and don't want that to happen because, you know, they are one of the good ones. And I know the good ones listen to the show. I know you do. And so if you also have a story and want to continue this conversation, because I do think it's important, I would love to hear from you as well. The more that we can understand these systems, the more we can spot the red flags when things go wrong, and we can help the kids in our lives and the kids in our kids' lives as well. So yeah, I just think it's a really important topic. And I'm so thankful for you, Casey, for saying, hey, I want to talk to you about this because I have some thoughts about this documentary as well. It was an interesting documentary. I definitely think it's worth a watch if you guys want to watch it. I don't remember where we watched it. I want to say it was on Amazon or, I don't know, Hulu maybe?
I think you watched it on Amazon. It's on Discovery Plus, and then I think it's on HBO.
Yeah, it's on HBO Max. So I watched it through Amazon on HBO Max. So if you're interested, I will throw the links to the documentary in the show notes. If you guys are going, what? How do I find this? Very easy. And we'll put those there for you. I want to say thank you again. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about before we wrap it up?
I would like to talk about just the issue of disability.
Of course.
With the Natalia situation. I think it's really missed, you know, just from what I see in the comments on social media, of people reacting to the documentary. what is kind of apparent in like the various neighbors and different ancillary people in the documentary that comment on Natalia, it's pretty clear that she was a victim of disability discrimination, ableism, pretty much right from the get-go. You know, we think about the way so easily. I mean, this is something that I feel like I see in foster care and adoption, where it's pretty easy for other people to believe parents when they're saying these horrible things about a child, even if, you know, they're not true. But with Natalia, I have to think that it was made that much easier because of her disability. You see it in the way that the neighbors talked about her. They looked at her, and of course she was disheveled because she was clearly neglected as a, you know, a neglected child. But they look at her and they're like, oh, they talk about her like she was a monster. The way her, you know, just her gait, the way she walked, the look on her face is just so like dripping with ableism and kind of fear. I think a lot of them may have gotten, you know, you can get bad vibes from a person. But when they're a person that looks much different than you, has a visible disability that maybe you're not that familiar with or have never been around people with that condition, I think there is a lot of prejudice.
Oh, definitely.
Like hidden in there that people weren't really cognizant of. And so they had maybe weird vibes from this girl and they didn't know why. Well, it's because you're, you know, you're freaked out because, you know, she's disabled.
Yeah.
You know?
There were so many moments where I felt so bad because I just, these people were using such ableist language. Even her own adoptive mother, Christine, would talk to her in like text messages with her friends using very ableist language about this girl she's supposed to love and be taken care of. It was really sick to see it. And, you know, people are people, and people that are unwilling to learn and grow and change will forever be stuck in those old ways of thinking that we're moving past. They're archaic. And it's really sad. I see a lot of ableism. One of the main concerns that really upset me was that they put her in an apartment on like the second floor. There was no ADA accommodations. She has dwarfism. She's tiny and nothing was adjusted for her size. Nothing, no heights were adjusted. There were not step ladders or anything so that she could easily reach things. She was not taken care of. And even the simplest of ways of somebody who has dwarfism would need special accommodations. Like none of that was taken care of. And it was horrific. And then to hear the language of the neighbors who didn't understand and how easy it is to be like, oh, well, I guess she could be 22. I guess so. Like, I don't know anything about that. And the ignorance and not wanting to learn about it and go, oh. And so even having conversations like this, to have people go, oh, I should be, like you said, more cognizant of people around me and people's disabilities and the differences that we have and learn to appreciate those things and understand those things as opposed to just casting them aside and being like, ew, gross, freak, run away, scary. It was very Frankenstein's monster the way that her neighbors were talking about her.
Well, not just cognizant of various disabilities, you know, people with disabilities, life experience maybe, but cognizant of our own internal bias. You know, if you have absolutely no reason to feel weird around this person, intuition is a thing. I'm not going to discount that. You need to have some self-awareness and think, why am I thinking like this? Why do I feel this way? Could it be that I'm just a little kind of off-put? You know, I was not expecting to see this little person looking disheveled, walking around in this apartment complex. And I think for a lot of the neighbors, they just knew, they just had an inkling that something was not right. And they couldn't put their finger on it. So they had to imagine something's not right with this girl. Well, something was not right because she was a child. Your intuition was correct. You just attributed it to the wrong thing. And then also the ableism, I don't think people realize that Natalia experienced right from the beginning with the Barnetts, with how unfamiliar they were with her condition. And of course, according to Michael, they didn't know anything about her medical history, blah, blah, blah. Season 2 shows they did know about her medical history. They at least had her medical records once they were, you know, had her. They provided them to the school. In the narrative about her precocious puberty, supposedly, that she supposedly had pubic hair, that she supposedly was getting a period, even though we, you know,
yeah,
can pretty much surmise that from the documentary that Christine was trying to make Natalia believe she had a period. Yeah.
Yeah. A lot of the evidence was manufactured.
imagine, you know, you just adopt a new little girl, 6-year-old, and you're giving her a bath and you see that she has pubic hair and she has dwarfism or she has chromosome abnormality or some kind of medical condition that's quite blatant, like you know about it. You see pubic hair and is your first instinct to go, oh, she must be an old woman pretending to be a child? No, Google was a thing back in 2010 when they adopted her. Precocious puberty is something that it's common, period. It's common in children, but it's common, especially in children with chromosomal abnormalities, anything that affects growth. It can come. I mean, anything that affects growth, like your growth plates, can also affect hormones and that sort of development. When your body reaches an equivalent to like about its teenage size, like almost the full size that it's supposed to be for the lifespan, those hormones and those things start getting activated. They could have Googled. They could have asked the actually, she did go to an endocrinologist and he attested to, you know, he thought this manifestation of her puberty was normal. He said it was normal. Just so many other things. Another thing that was brought up in season one was the supposed like bathroom incidents that she had to wear a pull up or that she would go to the bathroom on herself, that she would smear feces supposedly. There's so much to unpack there, but you know, never once did there seem to be any consideration about her medical conditions, her trauma. Children with trauma have some funny bathroom behaviors, some problems with constipation, encopresis. When you think, like, some of the home movies that Christine herself recorded that they showed in season one, you know, she's disciplining Natalia with physical acts, like making her stand on a wall that is visibly discomforting to her, that is physically hurting her because of her disabilities. And they're just like, oh, suck it up, blah, blah, blah. It's not only where there's just so much blatant ignorance to her medical needs, but willful ignorance, willful negligence is just awful.
Every expert they went to said, yeah, no, she's a little girl. And they were like, we don't believe you. Let's ask another expert. Like, I'm going to get a third, fourth, fifth an opinion on this. Every single medical expert, but they weren't talking to each other. And so there wasn't like, hey, this family keeps coming in. Is that weird? There, you know, it was just, again, like falling through the cracks, like doing just enough. It was just a horrific story. And the story ends with the family that she, the man's family, the evangelical family, deciding to ceremonially, because she's already an adult at this point, ceremonially, and I'm assuming you can adopt like for posterity and just because of having somebody legally being a part of your family, even though they're no longer a minor, they adopt her into their family. And then the series ends on a cliffhanger again, are we surprised, where the man's family is calling and saying, Natalia's crazy. We don't want her. We were wrong about everything. Oh my God. And like the series ends. And I'm just like, are we for real? Are we for real? Again, with the sensationalism, again, with the cliffhangers, again, with the drama of it being more important than the truth, because again, it's very sensationalized. So if you have a problem with that kind of stuff, you might not like it. But again, like I'm saying, the story, the downfalls, the cracks in our system, the way that people with disabilities are treated, the way that this little girl was treated with all of her issues and everything that she went through, just is so unbelievably heartbreaking. I do recommend it, but with the caveats that we talked about in this episode and understanding. And maybe once you listen to this episode and then you watch the documentary, you're like, oh, it made perfect sense because I had a Cliff Notes to go along with it. But I'm telling you, it was a very confusing, often infuriating, and very upsetting documentary to watch.
Yes. It kind of comes full circle, leaving off on the man's, you know, that phone call. The social media response, a lot of it was like, oh my God, I don't know what to think anymore. I don't know what to believe. I don't know who to believe. Honestly, I was upset by it, but I was not shocked, I guess. And just to bring it back to the beginning, like I said, these post-adoption issues are just such a common theme. It's not uncommon, unfortunately, that a family who has loved and been a fierce advocate for a child that they've fostered or adopted it's not unusual for this child to come of age and one family mishap happened. There might have been things along the way. They might have had a fight here. There might have been a crisis here and there. But one day for them to be like, all of a sudden, flip the script and talk about them in a way that's completely contradicting how they talked about her before. I mean, I've had a family that, suffice it to say, 1 month, you know, as the adoption was being finalized, they were ride or die for this child. This child was a gift sent from God. They would do anything for this child. It wasn't 6 months later. They were completely done. They talked about this child like they were a con man. They were living a double life. And the behaviors at the heart, once you start peeling back the layers, at first it sounds like, oh my God, this kid must be like dangerous. Like, what's going on? This kid must be hurting. Like, this kid must be all these horrible things that they're saying. And once you peel back the layers, it's really normal behaviors. It's normal kid, teenager behaviors. They're being mouthy. They're mouthing off. They're being smart aleck. They're cussing, getting on inappropriate websites they're not supposed to. They're getting bad grades in school. They're getting in trouble at school, not for anything major. Normal teen stuff, skipping class, like normal behaviors that, you know, they're not good, but that's what you expect. That's what you get for having a kid. Like, you get that whether you birth a child from your own loins or you adopt one. It's not out of the realm of normalcy for a family who just talked so highly of a child to all of a sudden sound like completely different people. And it's really sad. I've seen on social media where supposedly, you know, the mans are saying they can't talk about it. They can't talk about the end of the series. Natalia can't talk about it. So I guess we're going to have a season 3. I've seen the man say on social media that they're good. They're on good terms. They love Natalia. And I mean, I believe that. I believe, you know, they can leave that horrid voicemail and still love her. But I really wish that the production company was more considerate to the trauma of Natalia in this. And it's not just Natalia that's kind of at the center of this. It's like children in foster care, children who have been adopted, children with disabilities. They're seeing what people are saying online. They're seeing where people say, oh, she's been through 3 families. She must be the problem. Clearly she's the problem. I don't trust her. Yeah, I got it. Like, kids are seeing this and they may or may not be internalizing it because her experience is not that much unlike a lot of foster youth.
We have to be really aware of the way that we are presenting information and try to be ethical and victim forward. I mean, you know, yeah, that was probably my biggest gripe about this documentary is I didn't know who the victim was. I didn't know where to place my empathy. And I didn't like feeling confused and I didn't like feeling misled of where I placed my emotional baggage, where I put, you know, that concern. I don't like ping-ponging around. I like understanding and feeling for the victim and moving along the story. And I just don't think the documentary did a great job at that part. But again, like I said, worth a watch if what we've talked about today is interesting to you. Because again, it's something that's happening. These stories are going to be coming out a lot more. Once you tell a story, it opens up the gates for other people to come forward with their stories as well. And so being able to talk about these, give language to the behaviors in these stories, and sort of educate us on the red flags of what's going on so that we can spot it in other places is really valuable. And I want to say thank you, Casey, for joining me today and having this conversation. I know it's tough, but it was very pleasurable to have this conversation with you.
Thank you for having me. It's just, I could talk about it forever. You can talk about this for an hour and barely scratch the surface.
Right? Well, when season 3 comes out, we will watch it on Discord. I'm sure Casey will be in there as well. We can have a conversation. And then you'll have to come back and we'll have to discuss it in another bonus episode about season 3 and about what happened in that.
Absolutely.
Because I enjoy your insight about a topic I don't really know a lot about. So I really appreciate that.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Life After MLM. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. And follow us on social media at Life After MLM Podcast or visit our website at lifeaftermlmpod.com. And don't forget to check out our Patreon for exclusive content and join the community on Discord. You can find all of the links to follow in our show notes. Life After MLM is produced by Roberta Blevins. Audio editing is done by the lovely Kayla Craven. Video editing by the indescribable RK Gold. And Michelle Carpenter is our triple emerald princess of robots. If you have a story about a cult, fraud, scam, or MLM and want to be on the show, please hit us up. We would love to help you tell your story and start your healing journey in life after MLM. See you next time, Hunts. We'll be right back.